This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
So we actually have some announcements this week. So our first announcement is yet another request for listeners, if they can, to take the time to take our survey after you've listened to the show. In fact, we have a survey linked for each show where you can provide feedback and give us future suggestions for improvements to the show. And we've gotten some really great feedback so far from these surveys, so please keep it up and thank you. And the second announcement is today we're actually joined by a third interviewer. We have with us Pablo Prado, a friend of the show and also a software engineer himself. So please welcome him, and we hope that we can continue to bring on additional friends from time to time just to add some more knowledge and perspective to the week's topics. So Pablo, why don't you go ahead and just say hello real quick?
Yeah. Hi, John, James. Thanks for having me. I will try not to talk too much about myself because this one is not about myself. So I'll leave it at that. And we can ask questions to Mike.
Absolutely.
And speaking of this week's topic, today we're joined by Mike Renaud. Mike is the VP of Engineering for Takeout Central, a community-first restaurant delivery service located in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He leads a team of talented multi-platform engineers and works across the various elements of the business in order to align technology goals with the overall business goals. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Wow, we have a VP on the show. we have truly made it. Mike, we're so happy to have you here. Why don't we get started the way we often do? Why don't you go ahead and tell us what you do, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Like you said, I'm the VP of engineering, and mostly that means managing people day to day. On any given day, I'm managing the stand-up between my engineers, working with them to answer the individual product questions they may have on the features they're working on, fielding questions from people using the software, whether it's the customers, the salespeople we have using the platform, the drivers in our case, since we are a delivery company. Really just handling any questions about our platform, whether it's the future of it or bugs and current state of things.
I think this would be a good time to ask, can you just give us a little perspective for how big is your company and then how big is your team that you work with, or teams?
Yeah, so we are a small company. Our delivery areas only cover North Carolina, about 8 or 10 markets therein. Company size is about probably 20, 30 people, not including our drivers, which are all our contractors, and our restaurants, which are also doing all the work. And my engineering team itself is, I think I like to say it's about 4.5 people. My CEO happens to also develop here and there, so he contributes when he can. And I myself, I only count about, you know, a quarter or so, because I don't have a lot of time these days to contribute to the platform.
So at this point, you're not primarily like on the ground writing the software, but you're coordinating the people who are writing the software. Is that right?
Certainly. We have within that, we have 3 full-time people. One full stack engineer, and then 2 mobile engineers.
How long have you been with this company?
I just reached my 3rd year, actually, which is the longest I've been in a company, which is not abnormal in the software world.
That's true. I was about to mention it. It feels worth mentioning that Mike is our age, very, very young, and VP. That is quite a feat. How do you like managing versus developing? Because I don't know if I'll ever go that route myself, but it feels, I don't know if I could leave it so quickly.
It's been interesting. I have a kind of weird view of managing that lends from my background of electrical engineering, where when you're thinking about putting a product together or building or architecting a system, you can kind of think about each individual on the team's inputs and outputs and what their specialties are and what their strong suits are, and use that in such a way as like a in like a printed circuit might rely on elements of RAM or programs that run certain features here and there, adders, multipliers, etc. Sometimes a person's contributions to an overall product is in that same way, where you put someone where their specialty excels and where they themselves can feel excited enough about the thing they're working on to do the thing. And having knowledge of all of those extraneous and extracurricular ideas can help build a greater product.
So you're responsible for, at least to some extent, bringing on engineers, right, who'll be able to perform the tasks that you need them to do. To what extent, at least these days in your experience, do these engineers learn what they need to do on the job? When you receive them, are they just good to go and there's very little training? How does that go for a software engineer these days?
That's actually probably the most interesting question about my team in particular, because we all come from such different backgrounds. In particular, to step back a second, when I was first hired, I was simply a software engineer. I was the first full-time software engineer hire for this company. And kind of took that with stride, but saw hints therein that, you know, I didn't really have a manager necessarily. I was more of a person working on a backlog of things that had been building up for years. And saw within that room to take the reins and grow my position a bit more. From there in, we had some contractors working with us who were great contractors, but were hard to manage and hard to make us a priority because they were contractors and they weren't necessarily focused on our work all the time. So very quickly on, I wanted to bring parts of our development in-house, in particular the mobile engineering. And as luck may have it, one of our drivers in Asheville happened to have a computer engineering degree from Virginia Tech and had been kind of bouncing around for the last decade or so, had worked software out of college, didn't love it, ended up doing some woofing, world organic farming in Central America, became a sushi chef, became a delivery driver, came back and said, "Hey, I like working for you all, but your app isn't the greatest. Can I improve it?" And after, you know, some back and forth with the team about, you know, should we trust this guy with our source code? And we finally let him in. He did some work for us. It turned out phenomenal.
He didn't woof it up.
And after I think one release for both our Android and iOS app for the drivers, I talked with my team and said, "Hey, I want to hire this person." And as luck had it, they let me, and that started my team. That was the seed. From there, my work was ballooning out as we kept growing, and I essentially eventually petitioned for another person doing my role, but on a beginner side of things, and ended up hiring someone out of a boot camp from Durham, who he went to college, didn't ever finish. Ended up going to the reserves and realized, you know, he kind of wanted to step back and get into software. Went to a boot camp, graduated within a few months, came knocking on my door in a job posting, and, you know, really wowed me in the interview. And here we are, you know, now he works for me. And the third person of my team, he is a geology major from Colorado University. Who kind of also bounced around, lived in Florida at the time, and a recruiter, in this case, brought him to me from Kansas. And so now he works for us in Kansas as on our mobile side of things. So it's really a field that welcomes diverse backgrounds. And the thing I often talk about with my team and my executive team is, you know, the soft skills are the hard part. If you can work with us, if you can help us brainstorm and communicate what you're working on, I can teach you the technical stuff. I can teach you, or my other mobile engineer can teach you the actual nitty gritty of what you're doing day to day.
Soft skills are the hard part. That is a remarkable thing for people to hear.
Your question, John, was actually quite insightful because, you know, working for software myself, the you pick up a lot on the job. Like my background is from physics. Mike's is from electrical engineering. They take all kinds of people as long as you can like kind of problem solve in this kind of stuff. And it is amazing how important the soft skills are. That's why I never want to be a manager. I hate everybody, but it is remarkable how open it is and how much you can learn on the job, and how much you can not learn and still get away with pretending that you know.
Yeah, I think that goes into the other thing is a lot of what I look for when I hire and meet people is curiosity, because programming in particular, but computer science in general, are moving so fast and there's so much heavy research and it's still an early field. You have to keep up to date and you have to keep aware of what's happening on the horizon. And so even if you maybe don't have a formal background, you can pick it up with 6 months of intensive learning or 3 months of casual browsing.
So let's just say you're interviewing someone. Like what is the sign for you that somebody has like a sufficient knowledge of software? Because there must be some baseline that you need, right? In addition to the soft skills, how do they demonstrate that to you in an interview?
So in my case, I really like code read throughs. So we can get into this later, but our backend is in a pretty old language that isn't heavily used anymore called Perl. And often you're not going to find a 20-something-year-old who is hungry and ready to get into the working world and also who happens to have a diverse background in Perl or a well-knowledged background in Perl.
Actually, they know Perl a lot. They're most likely to be hungry, so.
Do you require that they know Perl when they come in, or are you going to teach it to them if they're willing?
Exactly, no. So what I usually do is I work from a point of view where every language has its idiosyncrasies and syntax and pitfalls and things to know. But in the very general case, languages can be adapted from one to the other. So someone who knows PHP or someone who knows JavaScript or someone who knows Python knows what a for loop is, knows what a variable is, knows what a function is. And I can show them and they can discern and infer what that looks like in Perl. So a lot of times when I do code walkthroughs, I show them a snippet of Perl code with a old-fashioned security error in it, security flaw. And my first hope is that they find the security issue. But a lot of the people, that security issue in particular, it's called a SQL injection. You mostly don't see it in the wild anymore. Because it's been solved with tools and abstractions. So I look to see if they can find that. If not, I look to see, can you see the parts of this Perl code that you recognize from other languages and other work to make sure that you know the basics of programming? Can you see you're bringing in outside libraries? Can you see that you're assigning variables? You see that you're printing to standard out? If someone looks at it and can't even begin, well, then that's the person who doesn't know code. As long as you can read a piece of code, especially one as strange as Perl, it has its weird elements, I can teach you how to do the rest.
I found in my job, we interviewed a bunch of people and we'd always ask them if they knew relational databases. And the answer was always no, but the way they answered it was always interesting, you know, a willingness, or some people would just dismiss it and be like, yeah, no, I'm not even interested. And it's like, well, that's not a good answer.
Yeah. I think that in the median cases, people will show you what they know in interviews and you don't have to go through a whole rigmarole to see, can you reverse a linked list is the historical programming question. You know, I don't think that's necessary because you're not going to do that in a day-to-day job. And the senior engineers are not there to make sure you can do that. They're there to make sure that you can contribute to their code base, which has its own idiosyncrasies and its own historical telling of, well, so-and-so 10 years ago made this feature and now we just support it because we have no other choice.
Is quick question for James and John, actually. Is the term SQL injection widely spread enough that you guys are familiar with it?
Oh, I have no idea what that means.
No clue. That's why we need you to translate, Pablo.
It's just a security flaw that is actually very, very silly. I don't know how much in depth you want to go into it, but let's say you create a website that adds something to a database, and it has the name, and so you allow, like, hey, Mike, give me your name, and Mike can put in his name, Mike, and so I'll go tell the database, add Mike to the database. But if Mike is nifty and a bad person, he can put his name as Mike, period, delete all tables, and the website back and whatever sees everything after the period as, instead of the name Mike as a perhaps new command, you can tell the database to do whatever by formatting stuff. That's not quite how it goes. It's the 10-second explanation.
Interesting.
Yep, that's exactly it.
I've seen that show up in
XKCD is the...
Yeah, I saw it on XKCD and didn't know what it was referencing, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a comic about naming a baby Drop Tables or something like that.
Yeah, Robert Drop Tables.
Exactly.
Yeah, I did not know what that was. But there's probably a reason for that, right? It's not like I've encountered that in my work.
Well, most programming languages provide very easy ways to avoid that, because it is such a serious security flaw that the tools have inherently built that protection on itself. So I had encountered it in a previous job, but most people our age in particular probably don't see it in the wild unless they're working with legacy code bases.
So you wouldn't even have to think about it with a newer language.
Exactly. The easy workaround for your listeners is called parameterization. You're treating them as parameters to a function as opposed to strings you just trust.
There you have it, everyone.
I think the golden rule in security, I think, is trust no input or something like that. That's what, there's some phrase like that that gets said a lot.
Why don't we take a minute, and then I want to get back to this detailed discussion. But just to put all this in context, can we talk a little bit about what your software does in the context of the actual business, right? So you're using all these tools to accomplish something in the real world. Can you just talk about what that is? And then we could talk a little bit more about how that interacts with people.
Certainly. So we have what the business world is called at this point, a three-sided marketplace. So we have a restaurant side of the marketplace where we have to recruit and retain and serve restaurants. We have to recruit, retain, and make sure our drivers are being tended to. And we have to bring in and serve customers. So that's our three-sided things. What that means for us is we have a central server architecture with some code on it that runs. And that is our website that serves the normal customer who goes to... They go to our homepage, they put in their address, they see the list of restaurants that serve them for delivery. They choose their restaurant, they go to the menu, they add a cart, just like you would on any e-commerce site, and press submit, and they can start order tracking. That they start tracking their order, it's in the world now, and it's handed off to our team. That's all our software right there. On the backside of that, you have a team of dispatchers, in our case, who are making sure that order gets to the right driver, making sure the restaurant's aware of anything that they need to be aware of. If it's the order gets sent to the restaurant and they are not answering calls because they're too busy, it's dinner time and what have you. So the dispatchers are calling them repeatedly if need be, and using their best judgment based on that marketplace to either cancel the order if they think the restaurant's closed. They might send a driver over there in some cases. And so we have this order queue system that monitors and ensures that orders get to the right place at the right time. And then we have on top of that, we have a customer app, which is the mobile version, the iOS and Android version of our website in a person's phone, a driver app, Android and iOS, that the driver then gets sent orders. They can see progress. They can track their earnings for the night. They can request invoices. They can see what the person ordered. you know, in some cases, I think the thing we always watch out for is, well, if you're getting pizza, the driver has to be sure they got two pizzas in their bag before they leave. You know, if the order says two pizzas, please leave with two pizzas.
Right.
And then we have our restaurant app, which is a newer feature, and that is what we use to send orders to restaurants. They can confirm, complete, and have that digital paper copy of what the order is so they can make it to the best of their ability.
Okay, so the software interfaces with the three people involved, right? The customer, the driver, and then the restaurant. And so your software, and I'm guessing they're different pieces of software, right? Or different apps for all three of those people, right? Because they're accomplishing different things.
You can think of the middle as being a central brain of it. Mm-hmm. And there are legs of it that communicate with each of those bits, but they all have to be kept in alignment so that a person doesn't cancel an order and the driver doesn't know of it.
But they ought to be outwardly facing, useful for the person that's dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh. How does the restaurant receive the order? And I guess what I'm asking is, like, are they constantly checking their phone, or is it hooked up to their whatever other system they use for their establishment?
So that's actually a very interesting question, personally, because I'm in this world all the time. We use a variety of mechanisms to send orders. We call and read off the order to restaurants. We do what's called an e-print. There are printers out in the world, I didn't know this, that have an email address associated with them. And when they receive email, they immediately just print out the order. That's one element. Sometimes we use a stand-in for that where a tablet is receiving the email instead. And they just have a Gmail account that has notifications on and they receive the order that way. The most interesting way I think I was surprised to learn about was that fax. A lot of restaurants still really like fax machines.
Yep.
And so we still send a lot of faxes.
It is amazing how many people still use fax machines. My dad has a business. He still uses a fax machine.
I think if I had to guess, I would say the pizza business in New York City in particular runs fax machines.
Yep.
A lot of the old Italian pizza restaurants want paper copies and they want them on a fax machine because they just have them around. And yeah, I've just heard stories about just how deeply run the fax machines are in those places.
Maybe it's a New York thing too, because my dad's business is in New York. I don't know, but they've always used it, and that's, they have their system in place and they don't see a reason to change.
Yep. And then the other side of that is then the tablet, like I mentioned earlier. So we have a tablet we developed an app for that receives a push notification. It's loud, it's annoying, so it gets past everyone at happy hour, making noise through it. It gives restaurants a bit more control. They can, in fact, even pause their own service there if they're too busy. We have some restaurants that are so busy in-house that they can't even handle our delivery orders. They don't want to call in and say, stop sending me orders. They then hit the pause button and orders stop. They have to finish the ones they're working on, but the orders otherwise stop coming in. I think that covers all the different options.
You mentioned the dispatchers. Are those employees of your company that are coordinating all of this live?
Yeah, so they are coordinating some aspects of it. They are, handling some special instructions, assigning drivers to orders occasionally, watching a map of all the orders all the drivers, really, not the orders. Making sure the drivers are staying in the market or we're at least aware of them and that they're keeping us up to date with what they're doing. Because a lot of times nowadays, especially, you see drivers driving for us and Postmates and Uber Eats and DoorDash all at once and just kind of alternating order taking.
As far as you're aware, do those, like, quote-unquote competitors also have dispatchers and stuff like that?
They have less dispatchers.
Okay.
We have a more manual system as of yet, where it's more like a ambulance system, like you might see, where like someone is in a back office making sure an ambulance gets to whoever called 911. And as a result of that, we also have a lot more customer service people. So in our cases, one of why we're community oriented and why we're focused on the people in particular is that you want your delivery service to sort of be like a restaurant. You want, if food messes up, if a restaurant messes up your food, gives you the wrong entree, you want the restaurant to resolve it as fast as possible. And that's what our customer service is there to do, to resolve that and make sure you can still have your dinner when you expect to have your dinner.
That's fair. Cause like accountability, I think it would be a big thing for these things. Like I mean, everyone has dealt with these services, right? Like something goes wrong, you don't know, do I call Uber Eats? Do I call Domino's, whatever? And then at the end of the day, you're just the hungry one. So.
Yeah. A lot of them, we don't have to get too much into this, but a lot of them actually just say place another order and then leave an email and we'll cancel out that order eventually, which is a strange option, I think.
You had Suresh in, right? Suresh, if I am correct, dealt with some trucks that evacuated some materials from planes and stuff.
Yeah, ground support equipment.
Okay, I thought that was disposal of the restroom facilities per se.
Absolutely,
I like it because now that you have Mike and you had Suresh, you have the whole nutritional cycle track.
The food in and the waste out.
Yeah. Now you just need a biologist to talk about the, you know.
Oh, that's forthcoming. There will be one, and then we can complete the cycle. Mike, I have a question.
Sure.
Why don't we get into this a little bit? So, can you just go into everything at a really high level?
Just go into everything, please.
Period. No. Everything that goes into writing the software to accomplish this goal. So, you know, again, just at a very top level, where do you start when writing the code? And what are the major components? Can you break that down?
Certainly. So when I first start working on something, it's usually because it's a business need from one of the various VPs we have on one of their sides of the business. And often that's either, you know, customers, drivers, restaurants. And I'll usually brainstorm with one or two of the other VPs about the best way to solve that based on their experience using software and my experience building software. And we kind of meet in the middle of what's feasible given time, given the team we have, the size of the team in particular, and kind of come to a middle ground of what the world might expect and what we can deliver. From there, I do some element of product management. I break that down into sizable bits. I often have to source out the design of that. If we need to design a new element, reach out to designers and look to see what we can build that kind of maps to our branding and kind of adds an element of fun. It's what I often seek to do. Joy is what I call it a lot of times. Aside of that is we just added a new spinner to our Android app. That's our icon, which is a flying fork. Our drivers are called delivery heroes. So there's kind of the superhero element to our brand and company. So the spinner is now a flying fork flying across your app as things load.
I love the thought of like professional software engineers focusing on stuff like that. Right?
Oh, you have no idea.
Well, so in particular with what I try to build, I want people to be on our app as little as possible. I want you to get to the app, place your order, get the confirmation, and be done. I would like you not even necessarily have to track your order. I want you to get as fast as possible back to being with your family or being in home doing what you're doing in such a way that we're not distracting you from that. And for whatever reason why you couldn't go to the restaurant that night, we want to bring you back to that thing so you can do that. So we'll work on the design, try to make it a little fun, try to make it a little goofy if we can. The copy, the words that tend to be used tend to have that element of like dad jokes, I guess. From there, kind of we bring the design to life. We work backwards from that point to say, okay, well, this feature exists in the design. How do we make that happen in the code? and then do that piecewise. And then usually there's elements behind the scenes that have to actually work to make the whole thing work a bit better than it otherwise may be based on the design. Because the design is 2D-ish, the architecture of the software is 3D or more behind that. From there, go ahead.
I was just gonna ask for the little jokes and the stuff that theme. Do the engineers have pretty much like free reign, or do you have like a PR team overseeing, or like a professional dad that you've hired, or something like that?
I think that the co-founders of the company tend to be those professional dads. They have that element, and no, we don't have a PR team. As a small team, that's more of a luxury, so we don't really have that.
So you just leave it to the executives.
Leave it to the executives to kind of proofread and add their little bits when they want. From there, I would say that we bring it to life. So me and the other full stack engineer usually work to...
What's a full stack engineer?
Good question. So full stack encompasses... I think it encompasses more nowadays. It used to encompass the front end, the what you see in your browser... I think that covers it. And the back end is the things that are happening behind the scenes to make the browser come to life. Usually that's a much a programming language, in our case, Perl. And the front end uses HTML, CSS, JavaScript.
Mm. What are you in your heart? A back end, front end?
I am a back end engineer in my heart. I've operated as a full stack for the most part, but design is not... Design is something where I often say I can't make design happen from a blank page, but I can see design and know design.
I know what you mean exactly. Yeah. Plus, in my opinion, in the back end is where the interesting problems are. The more algorithmic stuff, the more problem-solving stuff.
Yeah, it's the thing I usually think about it is that the front end is moving images and actual things around, like physical objects, making them move and appear and change state. Backend is moving data around. And from my mind, moving data around is a bit easier and comes a bit naturally. Hmm. So from there, the other full stack engineer and I usually work on how to break that issue down. We don't spend too much time breaking it into issues like you might see in other software engineering firms where you have more people and more infrastructure around each engineer. In our position, we work to break down big ideas into little ideas, little tasks on our own, which is often the thing I think that I learned the most from engineering school is how to break down a big thing into a small thing. That's often when people ask me about that, that's what I say. I spent 4 years learning how to learn like an engineer and break things up into doable tasks. And so once we get that done, we build out the feature. We run some tests on our own systems, run some tests on code that we have around. Sometimes we have to break things into multiple versions. So we get a workable version that does sort of the thing we want it to do. We test that out, get it out in the world just so people have an answer to that question they've been trying to solve. And then we go back around and we improve it and improve it, improve it. That's the agile workflow, as it's called, is constant improvement.
So with all that, you have your army of three engineers, three full-time engineers to do all of this. Are they all full-stack engineers, or do they have their areas of expertise or their domains where they stick, or are they not?
And I'll actually add to that question so you can answer both at the same time. Is work in general in the company divided per area like that, front end versus back end, like app versus the service behind, or how do you guys divide?
So in our case, the person working on the back end tends to be the same person working on the web front end. And then with that, we have separate people who work on the mobile side of the application side of things. So we have one engineer who focuses on Android, one engineer who focuses on iOS. They both have some kind of cross-discipline ability, but for the most part, they focus on those two things. So when we build things for the back end and the front end on the web, we're often building in features for them to also enable that to work on the application as well. And then as things go, we are a web-first company, so to say. So we're building things for the website before they're built for the app. So things like, in our case, using gift cards. We have gift cards enabled to buy food on the website. We don't have that functionality yet on the app. So you, in order to use a gift card you buy from us, you have to actually go to the web to order with it.
Is that because it's easier to design on the web, or why do you go web first?
So in our case, we went web first because we have been doing web. So the company's history is that they've been around since 1996. And about 10 years ago is when the co-founders I work under first bought the company and worked with from then. The web has just had a head start in all those things. Yeah.
Is the mobile caught up, or is it still got a long ways to catch up to?
It's catching up, but because I can release an update to the website at any point of the day immediately, relatively speaking, the app, we are on a 2-week release cycle for a version of the app, and our specialty engineers are not quite up to speed. We have one who's still mentoring the other one. And so they're working together on the Android app while that person gets up to speed.
That's a really interesting distinction to make, because when you have a when you have a website, right, it's stored on the web server, your updates are basically instant, right? You could publish them instantly. But whereas with an app, if you make an update, isn't it true that the user needs to download a new updated version of the app for that change to take place? Or is there a way around it?
So for that process, because we host our app on the app stores, the native app stores for the devices, so the Google Play Store and the iOS App Store, Apple has to approve the iOS App Store updates, which takes anywhere between 3 hours and 2 weeks. And the Android Google Play Store, Google takes anywhere between 30 minutes and a week or so.
31 minutes. Oh.
Just recently, I think in the last year, Google has put in a more thorough reviewing process for their apps, and so they're a little bit slower than they might have used to be. And for that matter, COVID has slowed down the review process a little bit as well.
Has COVID helped your business or hurt it? Because deliveries, you know.
So COVID has brought more people to our service that maybe were on the fence about ordering from us. And because we partner with our restaurants, which is a distinction I can go into, but is not necessarily important. We partner with our restaurants a bit more closely than larger delivery services. Restaurants tend to recommend us a bit more. So when people are looking to help their local restaurants, local pizza places, local Thai restaurants, Mexican restaurants, they tend to look for who the restaurant recommends, who's giving the restaurant a fair shake. And a lot of times the restaurants recommend us for that. And so it helped us a little bit. But of course, now that we're in month 6 of this, some restaurants have been shutting down and are still struggling despite the turn to delivery. And unfortunately, we can't exist without restaurants. So we're doing everything in our power to make sure they stay open long term.
I feel like delivery services are helping. Well, maybe not 100%, but certainly at least postponing and doing a percentage of, you know, keeping business alive.
Yeah, I think it's helping. It's keeping restaurants from not having any service. It's offering a solution for people who don't necessarily want to do takeout. They want someone to deliver their food. But I don't think that it meets the need of what they would see for in-house eating. In addition, you know, when you partner with a restaurant, you're taking a commission of orders. And so you have to make up a little bit more to serve those people. Because as we are a marketplace in between them, we have to also pay the driver and also pay our keep the lights on in our own shop.
Mike, I did have another question. This is a this fascinates me with a lot of business, but I want to hear your perspective from us, from the software perspective. So you mentioned that you were the first full-time software developer at your company, right? And I think you also mentioned, correct me if I'm wrong, so before you then, it was the software development was contracted out to people outside of the company. Is that generally correct?
The software was primarily done by the CEO, who was kind of filling my shoes in addition to being the CEO prior to me joining.
When the company started, was it always using software, or did it even kind of like predate the age where software was, or where the internet was as big as it is? When was your company founded?
1996 is when the company was founded. We like to joke that it was back, not really, because back then you used walkie-talkies. That's how you communicated to drivers and dispatch orders out. People would call in, and that is something we still have to this day. People can call in their order to us and tell us what restaurant they want to order from, and then we'll place the order for them. So back then, in 1996 or so, it was walkie-talkies and phones and cash in particular, which are all feel antiquated now. I think about 2 years after that, someone local built a web for them using the technology of the time, so Perl. And then that was back in, I think, 1996. They had a website, and we inherited that when we bought that company.
Hmm. Okay.
So probably about 1996, 1997, 1998-ish, along with the .com boom, they had a web interface.
Interesting. Okay. And I guess the question that I was asking is, because right now you seem to be maybe more than before, maybe not, fairly vertically integrated. In other words, you're able to handle all of your software updates in-house with your team of software engineers. What are the advantages and disadvantages of being that way, of vertically integrating your teams as opposed to just working with outside vendors for this sort of development?
This is something I've had to think about quite a bit, because I have moved a lot of our software work in-house. Prior to it being in-house, So I guess to talk about contract in particular, usually you either contract someone hourly or you pay them a lump sum and they do the amount of work you specify with that lump sum given. Both of those have, I would say, troubles. Both of them have issues in terms of incentives for me. In the case of the hourly contractor, they're incentivized in that case to spend more time doing the work than they may otherwise have slated originally and given you the quote for originally. And so if you have a lot of turnaround where you're selling them, hey, I don't like the work you're doing, fix this. Now they're getting paid to fix a problem they created themselves. In the lump sum thing, a lot of it's the same stuff where you give someone a lump sum and they're trying to get it done as quickly as possible. So it's not going to be the quality software you are hoping for. So both of those require a lot of vetting to make sure the people working on the software are going to treat it as if they have to support it for the next 5 years. Because one of the issues with software is that you can write code, and I can write code, and anyone can write code, but supporting it is the hard part. Making updates to it, making changes to it, extending it, fixing bugs in it, because all software has bugs. That's the hard part. And if you pay someone to make a version one or a MVP, a minimum viable product, they are not incentivized to also support version two unless you're telling them. And even so, they may want to spend a long time rewriting version two because they made mistakes in version one and they get paid more if they take longer. Whereas the person in-house has the benefit of they're there for the long haul. They're there to support this code as long as they choose to stay at this company, and you have a lot more oversight in small ways to make sure that what they're working on each day meets the quality you need it to meet.
But so earlier you had mentioned that the turnaround for software engineering is quite quick, like 2-3 years. So that in a way it's a little bit contradictory, because that looking forward to what product you're going to leave behind, if you're going to leave it 2-3 years, that incentive to look ahead is also not, it's definitely stronger than for a contractor. By the way, certainly. I'm saying this knowing what the experience is. I'm just prompting you for it.
No, you're right. And it's true. Part of that also is that, so a lot of our projects, I get a turnaround. I get the product back to me to be released or to be quality controlled in about 3 months. Our products are pretty small. They're not large projects. I try to keep it pretty finite in scope. So like the person working on it for three months doesn't have the incentive to work on it in a year. The person in house is going to work on it as long as possible. And it's also a personal element. I think that when they have to add a version 2 to their own code, or they have to sit next to the person working on a version 2 for the next code, they don't want to be harped on for making otherwise foolish mistakes.
Right. Yeah.
Or shortcuts.
I feel like that the thing that causes most efficiency in junior developers is the shame of code reviews. The personal element of because for John and James, the way it works, I don't know if you've used Git and source integration stuff ever much. The way it works, you have like a version of the master code, which is what the product releases and stuff like that. And James, for example, let's say you want to do a feature, so you do a copy of that code, then you start changing stuff on your own. But James has to work on it. Who did I use for the first person? I said James twice, right? Then somebody else with a different non-J name, Mike, wants to do his own feature, so he's also got to do a copy of the code. But if you have whatever, it's Mike, help me out.
It's just tracking of documents. So if I make a change, I put it up to the central repository, and then you check out your own copy of that, make a change, and you can track your own changes on your local system. And if when you're ready, you take what is from the central repository, compare it to what's on your local machine. Someone can look at the difference and see what changes you make and vet that for quality and correctness.
And so the changes that you made before they get integrated into the product version of the code have to get reviewed by a bunch of people. And boy, there's a lot of shame in there. Like, because they'll leave comments, and if you're unlucky and you end up with a, like, I've heard some horror stories of junior developers, their first time around, they're super shy about it. They're very scared, and comes a senior developer, did a monkey write this? And they feel awful. Fortunately, I've never had that, but
code reviews have been weaponized, I think, in a lot of companies, where they'll use it as political tools to maybe keep a junior developer full of shame, I guess, is the best way to put it, or use it to force someone to dwell on a piece of code they've written and not let them pass it into the main system. In a poorly managed team of people, it can be very toxic. It's definitely a place where you have a lot of issues.
What's typically the approval process? Because even like in engineering, like I do, it's a similar thing where it's not code, but it's drawings or specs or anything like that. What's the approval process like to get something onto the main, the main source code?
The main branch or the trunk, we call it.
Okay.
So it's mostly peer review, like you might see in science. I review code that I'm familiar with. Like, so the junior engineer the full stack engineer I work with, I'll review his code. He'll review my code. We'll make sure there's no obvious mistakes on the way. And then the mobile engineers will review their own code. Hmm. Prior to having two mobile engineers, I was reviewing the mobile engineer's code, and I don't have the eyes for it that a person well-versed in the system would. And so in that case, those reviews have improved tremendously. And, you know, going back to code reviews being weaponized, I've been lucky and I've fostered a team that takes a lot of pride in everything we do. And so it's against that work ethic to drag someone down because they wrote code. I do my best to instill a level of humility in everything we do. Like I said earlier, all code has bugs. There was a really interesting Fast Company article from the 90s where I think one of the space shuttle teams working on the code for one of the 90s space shuttle said that they've narrowed down their code to 3 bugs and they were working on solving those. Even their code has bugs. Every piece of code has bugs. And once you accept that and you accept that it's not a human failing to have bad code or have code that has issues later down the line, you can then work to improve the human processes that are letting that code reach the customer.
So Mike, this was an excellent conversation so far. Can we talk a little bit about how you got to where you are as far as how long have you been interested in software or this current field that you're on? And then what steps did you take to get there as far back as you want to go?
Sure. I really like talking about this because I came from a place where I did not know any other engineers. My neighborhood growing up, it was a lower income working class neighborhood. My mom was a hairdresser. Dad was a carpenter. And that was kind of the scope of what careers looked like to me. It wasn't until I moved and went to a school in South Carolina for high school that I started meeting people that did other work and kind of realized that a different career opportunity was available to me. It wasn't just reserved for certain people with certain abilities that knew it back in high school. I didn't know anything of what I wanted to do back in high school. In fact, when I applied to college, I applied under a degree of mathematical sciences because I said, I know math and I know science and I like both those things. Why don't I choose that? It wasn't until I think the summer prior to that, when I was like, wait, what do you do with a job in math? What do you do with a degree in mathematical sciences? And I was pretty, and still am pretty career oriented in that, like, well, whatever I do has to make some amount of money. I have to have some stability, because that was an issue growing up. And was like, well, mathematical sciences, you get a master's or a doctorate and you do something that I didn't quite understand at that point in time. Switched that job to computer science major to computer science. And that was when I told my parents I switched to computer science. My dad said something funny looking back on it is that, like, well, why can't you just learn that here? Why do you have to go off to school to learn how to program? And because his background was carpentry, but also his dad sold big mainframe computers back in the 60s, 70s, up to the 90s, and taught him Fortran back then. And he was like, well, I know Fortran. Why can't you just go learn programming somewhere? Why do you have to go to school for it? And I was like, I don't know yet. I don't know why I have to go to school for this, but there's a degree in computer science, and I think that's what I need to do.
I need to go to school to know why I need to go to school.
Right. It felt like there was something to be learned in 4 years that I couldn't just pick up in a summer at home or something. Mm-hmm. And I think I've circled back around where now I don't necessarily think you need to spend 4 years, but I digress. Well,
you can do the boot camp thing. That's so big now.
There are other options and there are problems with boot camps, but for the most part, they're a great in for people who weren't exposed to this early enough on that they could have gone to school for it. So anyway, studied computer science, got to my sophomore year and was in algorithms and data structures class. I had a lot of trouble understanding, like fully grasping some abstract components of software engineering and algorithms and data structures. And I completely failed that exam, failed that class. I think halfway through, a buddy of mine, we both switched our majors the same day. I switched my major to philosophy and he switched his to computer information systems.
I remember when you went through that, we talked about it a lot when you left computer science.
Yeah. And I think I circled back around and said, well, I'm going to get a doctorate in philosophy and I'm going to teach philosophy in some college, university somewhere. And that's my path from now on. And I think that's that semester following, I wanted to finish up some calculus classes because I still liked calculus and still wanted to, even though it wasn't required by my major, I still followed through with those. And by the end of that semester, realized that while I like philosophy, I still needed to be career oriented. I was going to say,
because you started off by saying, like, I'm super career oriented. And then you're like, oh, doctorate in philosophy, which philosophy fascinating, but hard to subsist right. on.
It was a weird semester. I remember.
Well, there's an important thing to notice that, like, at least note that, like, I don't think that I had the means behind me that I could fully commit to a doctor in philosophy. And realized that I had to get back to a career track of some sort. And by the end of that semester, I picked electrical engineering, and for another foolhardy reason in that I liked soldering and I liked working with electronics because I worked in the local theater and worked at the back of house there and liked fixing microphones and liked working with electronics. Turns out I grasped electrical engineering pretty well, and I understood the abstractions that they were working with without too much effort, and it just clicked with me. And by the end of that degree, I had enough understanding of what was happening behind the scenes of a computer, the electronics, that I could go back and take that data structures and algorithms class, and I passed it just fine. I learned enough of the background and the base structures that build up to that thing that I could finally understand the abstractions they were making and taking at that point.
That's quite a route to get full circle there.
It is, yeah.
The more things you try out, the more sure you are when you settle down.
Yeah,
but your degree when you graduated was electrical engineering, right? It wasn't like software engineering or something.
Yeah, it was electrical engineering with I ended up having enough credits to get a minor in computer science.
Okay,
so I leveraged that and. And going back to needing to make money, when I graduated, realized that for the most part, a degree in electrical engineering, at least from the school we went to, was not enough to work at a lot of companies as a self-sufficient electrical engineer. There was a lot of on-the-job training required, and you had to really find a company that was going to grow with you and build with you to teach you what electrical engineering looks like in the real world, and found that there were a lot more job opportunities for software engineering, and I went that path.
How different is software engineering from computer science? For somebody who doesn't do any of that, I can't tell the difference between them.
Yeah, so the thing I always use to compare them is that software engineering is the act and the science of building software as a team. Whereas computer science is improving and exploring the tools with which to write software for computers.
Okay.
The example I often draw from is a friend of mine from FIT now is a professor, and she works at a university. She studies programming language and, in fact, is working on building more structurally sound languages and exploring how better you can mathematically prove programming languages. And this is cutting edge stuff. That this is computer science. This is not how to build software at scale. This is how to build software 10, 20 years from now.
I have one other question, and this is kind of like beyond your background history, but it's one that fascinates me. There was a time the United States and the world is going through a change, right? There, and it's maybe we can call it the digital era, where more and more people's jobs that previously were safe in, say, manufacturing or service are being automated, and they're being replaced by whatever, right? You go to a restaurant these days, and now rather than having four tables to a waiter, there's 10 tables to a waiter, and they don't interact with the waiter. They interact with an iPad on the table. Right. We're seeing this. Jobs are getting automated. And there's a phrase that almost turned into like a joke and is almost derogatory in some places, which is learn to code. So people say, for all these jobs who are displaced, say a truck driver, no big deal. You don't have your old job. Just learn to code and you'll be fine. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that that is a viable thing for just to take people who had totally different careers and say, learn to code, this is the hot new career path, anyone can do it?
No. I think if you look at, I can't remember the site, it was using some amount of research to determine what the best job security you can have for the next 50 years was. And I can't remember what it said exactly about software engineers, but what was more stable than software engineers is social workers. The people who work to make things more human are the ones that are going to probably have more job security in the future than anyone else. I think that while you can automate away the waiter, the bartender, those things, I think that is going to be missing something. I think that there's a human element that's missing in all those things. I think that social workers are really important, in particular in hospitals, in many ways that I can't even name off the top of my head, but they're very important for bringing that element of humanity back to the business folks a lot of times and being an advocate for those people. And I think that says a lot about what we're going to need, even if everything becomes automated away. I think, and going back to, I think what your original question was, I don't think everyone necessarily would enjoy coding. I think that I think that coding for a lot of people allows them to, I think it's a loaded term, but like enter the middle class. I work with some boot camps and I've met a number of people who were teachers or were working for as IT people in law offices or doing some other position and were maybe not struggling, but not, they weren't doing well enough that they could allow themselves to think about further things to develop about themselves. And I think that the relatively ease, the relative ease you get once you are a software engineer and the salaries that that affords you allows you to think about what are the things you like doing and what are the things you prefer doing, and allows you to not think so much about what you're working at and what you're working on, but think about what do you want to do in your spare time now that you have time to think and relax. And I think that also lends to why software engineers at a given job only last 1.5 to 3 years, because there's a short lifespan of, well, when do you want to be a manager? Or when do you want to be a senior engineer? Great. 10 years, you've done it. What else do you want? There's still 30 years left in your career potentially. And a lot of people go out and then become musicians, become comedians, become other things that they may not otherwise have had time to think about and realize they enjoy doing had they not found a career in software. And I think that that also goes back to software is very boring to work on. You're sitting at a desk and you're staring at a screen and it's not particularly social, except when you have time to talk to your coworkers, because when you're working on a problem, it requires focus. It requires 20 minutes to an hour of focus at a time. And not everyone enjoys that work. And it's a drudge for people to sit at an office 8 to 9 hours a day and work on that. So it's just, it's not for everybody.
When you say that you have to concentrate it, like you don't get a lot of social interaction, you mean that as a pro, right? As a pro, right? That's a bonus.
I think that for some people it is. I think
I know, yeah. I think for introverts, actually, it can be a great job. I think, John, the just learn to code thing, I think it's just because coding software is the current bubble, right? So that's just what you tell people, okay, go to kind of insensitively when they get displaced.
Well, I think, Mike, you also said something I thought was really interesting. It's a route for a lot of people into the middle class, right? Because it's kind of like an equalizer, right? You could be rich or poor, or it doesn't matter your background. Like, some people, it seems it comes naturally to them. Like, they just start doing it on their own, and then boom, they have a great career path, whether they're from like a good neighborhood or a bad neighborhood. I don't know how common that is in practice, right? Because I know a lot of people have 4-year degrees, and that's not easy for some people to get.
But I think that was an interesting thing you noted. Like, some people are very good at it that I know anyway. And they could do really well with it, or they might not have been like, they might not have had the patience to do other jobs or the ability.
Yeah. And it's a very wide ranging field. And
I don't know if I agree with that, because it is in practice, but I found that a lot of junior engineers go in expecting like, oh, maybe tomorrow I'll be working in AI, and the next week I'll be working in some machine learning visual computing thing. But I would say that 80% of the jobs out there are code monkeying, if that's a known term.
I remember that phrase.
So I do agree with, I think there's a lot of options opportunity. I do enjoy that as well. I specifically enjoy that about my company. There's a lot of movement, but I think it is also important not to get too blindfolded by what you might think it is, because I know that I did that a lot.
No, and I completely agree. Like I said, I've worked with boot camps, and there's always the question you get with young mentees or your age mentees, where they ask you, you know, well, should I go to a small company or a big company? And from what I've seen in my own career and close friends' careers, the smaller companies tend to allow you to have more exploration of things. I have to solve every day a new problem, and I have to look to what technologies are out there to solve that problem, and I have to quickly learn and apply that thing. Whereas in bigger companies, there is the factory effect, where you don't need someone who is a jack of all trades. You need someone who's very good at drilling a hole, and you have them drill a hole every day because they're very good at it, and maybe their manager doesn't want them to ever leave, and then they don't give them the opportunities, and there's a siloing effect at some bigger companies that some people get trapped into. And then there's people who excel at big companies either doing that or by the other elements of how they can move around.
There was an interesting phrase I remember I heard in my line of work, which was, if you become irreplaceable, you also become unpromotable. And I thought that was really interesting.
It's very true.
And I think this would also be a good segue. There's a couple more questions we wanted to get to, but one of them is, Mike, what advice would you give to someone who does want to do something that you're doing? And say they're younger or they're earlier in their career or not. What advice would you give them as the VP?
Can I push back and ask where in their career they are?
Say they are, all right, they're either just beginning their career or they're still in training.
Or could be like in college or thinking about college too.
Yeah. Or you can make it piecewise, right? And say, yeah. If you're in high school, do this. If you're in college, do this, and so on.
Well, you think about it, Mike, just because I see you thinking, I'll just fill in the silence by saying that I think your guests, John and James, might be just a tiny little bit worse than mine and Mike's, because these things change so quickly. Like, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe mobile development, you tell people, like, go into mobile development, you're going to big bang. And now it's all services and AI and who knows. And that's all the feeling of silence I have, Mike. So I hope you came up with an answer by now.
Sure. The thing I tell most people is follow your own curiosity. I think that lends itself to a career you might enjoy, might being the powerful word there. I have read stories on Twitter of someone who, they were in one of their jobs and they developed a fascination for SVGs, a type of image format, vector format for the internet. And they loved it and they explored with it. They played with it. They developed with it. They pushed its limits, and they were really curious about it, and they just found a lot of questions to ask and be answered by it, where in one day they were at a conference and they heard some people talking about it, and they jumped in and said, oh yeah, this is not supported in this browser because this and this. And it happened to be that they were talking to the founder or the creator of that format, who was like, oh really, I didn't even know that. And you know, they've developed this career separate from that thing, but that's like a hobby, and that, you know, it's an accent to their career, so to say. And you know, a lot of people come in and they ask about like the small company, the big company, the if you just develop a community around you, you find a manager who cares about you and cares about your future, you find a company that isn't trying to trap you and cares about your growth while also meeting their business goals, and you just find all these things, if you can find them as a person, as a young person, if you even want to think about those things, then you should do that thing. If you don't want to think about it, before I got this job, I purposefully chose positions that would allow me to have a lot of work-life balance, so I could hike and I could learn mountaineering and I could pick up new skills that I derided the idea of spending all my time doing work. And now I care about what I'm working on to the point where I have a very poor grasp on work-life balance at times. And I'm okay with that. And I choose that right now.
All right.
I don't think that there's follow your curiosity is the thing I recommend people, and just explore what things that pique your interest, because you're going to like those a lot more than necessarily your day-to-day job.
I don't know if I want to point this out, but notice how depressive my answer was compared to Mike's, who is follow your dreams. That's the effect of working in a small company. They care about you. I am not encouraged to follow my dreams. They tell us, leave us your dreams at the door. And
one of the things I like asking my team of engineers, just to give a sense of a temperature about how they're feeling about what they're working on, is, you know, when's the last time you wrote code you're proud of? And for the most part, talking to them, it's every day. They're very proud of what they're working on. They're very proud of the people they're serving, because we put that first. And I talk to them about who the customers are and who the drivers are and making sure that their needs are being met. And I've not met as many people from other companies who have that sense of pride.
Yeah, no, that question almost killed me. What's the last time I wrote some code that I was proud of? Oh, God. You might as well ask a computer, like, this. You tell us an AI, this sentence is false. That's what my brain happened, right? I just...
Yeah, that's an important thing, you know. Where I am, you know, they like you to take some pride in what you do, and it makes you feel a little better, and, you know, I guess that's important to some people.
The caveat of small businesses, I think I've made them a bit too rosy. You're not paid as much as you are at Microsoft or Amazon. So if you want that paycheck, go to those places.
So, we got a term for that. Golden handcuffs.
Golden handcuffs.
Yeah. If there's a term for it.
So there is a place, and this is true with every single career path, right? Everyone needs to find out for themselves how important money is and how important these various other things are, because there's ways to make money. There's ways to be happy. And if you're really lucky, you could find a job where those overlap. But I think for a lot of people, it doesn't overlap completely, or the overlap is really small. They need
certainly. To seek out. I found where I am. I work for the government, and it's a big business, but like a small business, it's a small paycheck, good benefits, but mm-hmm. you're usually proud of what you're doing.
From what I understand, because I'm not from the US, government jobs are really nice in that way, right? Like, benefits are, like, if you lock into a government job, I've heard that that's a good place to be.
Yeah, great benefits, low pay, but, you know, you get a good work-life balance.
On that, why don't we talk about, I think we have, we'll ask one more major question. This is a
real philosophical.
One more question for you, Mike. Well, okay. There's going to be another one after this, so just get ready. But the last kind of real question is, what gets you excited about the future of your craft, your profession, your business? And similarly, or alternatively, what are you concerned about with the future of this industry?
What do you classify as my field?
I don't know. What do you classify as your field? Kind of just your profession, or I don't know what you're working on.
I mean,
it's open-ended.
You're in the best position to classify what your field is. So that answer, I mean, I would say software development. If you want to be more specific, that's fine.
Okay. So the future of software development, from my eyes, it's only going to improve. And there's a lot of strong steps being made towards improving the rigor of it. In particular, software engineering, in my eyes, is not engineering necessarily, because it's not as structurally sound as a thing, and there's not as much developer consequence if it's not structurally sound as a result. And I think that it would be improved, and it will be improved in the future as we work on those elements. And there's great headways being made in terms of what's called chaos engineering, where, you know, what happens if some rogue IT person goes through your server rack and unplugs all your servers? How do you plan for that? Is that going to destroy what your customers are doing at the moment? Is that going to have a fallback to a fallback to a fallback? And up until probably the last decade, very few people had been thinking about that. The thing I often talk about with friends is, if you compare software engineering to civil engineering, when you build a large building, you don't just tear it down and do V2 on top of it. You make improvements, and you are stuck with that thing that you designed and developed so thoughtfully ahead of time, hopefully, that you then can, you plan for improvements, you plan for changes, you plan for repairs. And software doesn't have that at the moment. There's still the, even if they don't say it anymore, there's still the move fast and break things mantra among a lot of software engineers. And
isn't that one of the hallmarks of them? Like you said, like the agile strategy.
Mm-hmm. Agile was an answer to the fact that in the 90s, if you let someone work on something in a waterfall method, they could be in their office for a year and not produce anything. Agile was an answer to, well, what? How do we make sure people are being accountable and are thinking about making products and moving as fast as software can allow? And I think that that kickstarted things away from how it was being developed prior. But there's a reason why you don't see a lot of, I can't speak for space right now, but at least in the air industry, I don't think that plain software is being developed in an agile methodology. You don't throw some software on and plan to patch it if bugs crop up. You're doing it in waterfall ways where you're doing very thoughtful design documents ahead of time, breaking that down into smaller design documents. And it's this expensive and thorough process that tends to produce better version ones and better version twos. And it's not very business focused. It's not very, there's a time and a place for things, right? So it's happening in airplane software because there's a mission critical need for things to not go wrong in planes, hopefully.
Engineers are big on first time quality. That's one of the bugs,
right? And software doesn't have that. Software doesn't care about that. Software says, well, we'll fix it in prod. You know, like it's a joke, but it's kind of serious that a lot of people just, and it's a problem, I think. And it goes back to accreditation. The industry that gives engineers accreditation does, you know, call yourself an engineer, the PE, the FE. They tried to do a software engineering one and no one did it. So they stopped offering a software engineering one. And that goes back to, well, if a bridge collapses, the engineer who signed the document that says this bridge won't collapse is now liable for that bridge collapsing. What happens when my healthcare software collapses and a patient can't be served? Who's accountable for that? And there's not enough accountability in software, and I think there should be.
So that fits under an area of improvement or hope, or is that an area of concern for you in the future?
It sounded like a little of both.
Yeah,
I would say it's a little of both. I have more higher concerns than that. I have more faith that that's being worked out as there are people working on chaos engineering and bringing elements of what's it called? What's the the people who study why certain toggles in planes cause the person to think they were upside down when they're not. Oh, man.
I don't know that one.
Having a major brain fart. They had a class for it at FIT.
It's not the dyslexia, right? Like, I'm hearing, like, a switch that's on or off and getting flipped.
There was some plane that had too many axes of change, and it was causing people to fly off the runway or something, or land incorrectly when they had all the knowledge given to them, but it wasn't given to them thoughtfully. There was too many things happening at once.
Information presentations.
Is that like human factors?
Human factors, yes. People are finally taking human factors and putting it into software.
Mm.
And it's becoming a new part of research, and it's going to help. It's going to help the more we take humans into what we're doing and building.
That's fair, because like if you'll go and the expectation nowadays is you open a new app and you don't have to read how to use the app. You should open it and like automatically kind of know how to use it. It should be intuitive. And like there's a lot of research that goes on into, is this button going to be placed here or here? There's a ridiculous amount of discussion that happens into that kind of stuff.
Interesting.
And it's evolved from, say, UX research, where places like Facebook and YouTube have tried to monetize and make sure you're engaged as much as possible, to strong advocates speaking to more humane technology that considers, well, we don't want this person to spend all day on this app. How do we get them off it occasionally? Even TikTok, for all of its bad qualities that people harp on about, if you're on the app too long, they send you a TikTok that says, hey, you've been on this app too long. Why don't you step away and do something? And I think it's a joke on the app that it's annoying, but that's a thoughtful touch that you don't see on Facebook. Facebook doesn't tell you after an hour of being on it that you've been on it too much.
I don't need my apps judging my lack of social interaction, Mike. let me look at a screen all day.
And in that case, you know, there's casinos for people like that. There's no clocks on the wall in a casino, and they're designed to keep you in there as long as you will be in there. And I think that there's a humane element that needs to be added to account for, I can trap people in here all day because I'm so serotonin boosting and doing all this, but should I?
Yeah. There's some computer engineering courses that are requiring an ethics course adjoined to them nowadays as well.
I think that's a good step. Unfortunately, I think that there's still a tone in a lot of those courses that this is kind of a joke.
Oh, 100%.
I can see that.
And I think it's a cultural shift that people are working on making happen, and I'm also applying whenever I build a product.
That sounded like a concern.
No, I'm hopeful. There's advocates speaking out for that. There's the Center for Humane Technology that's doing great work in podcasts and communicating to people what inhumane technology looks like and how you can build and design structures for how to build humane tech.
Yeah.
Like that was not happening 5-10 years ago, and now it is. I don't know if I would have even thought of those things back then. So that's a huge area where we're finally working on this. I'm optimistic for that.
Do you guys ever worry about like the long-term health detriment of how often we interact with our software platforms and our social media and everything? Like I feel like this is an experiment that we're just all doing as a nation and as a world. And
let's see what happens. We're all blind and deaf from wearing headphones 60 years from now because we had no research on that kind of stuff. Is what you're talking about?
I don't know. Like, is something happening in our brains? Maybe we need to get a tech psychologist on the show to discuss this. Like the way humans interact is changing drastically by the day, like over the last few decades. And I'm curious where to go. Like all of us right now, we're talking and we're in four different states. We're all of us right now. And it's just totally normal. Like we didn't even pause to think about how crazy this is.
At the current moment, I'm more worried about the short-term effects in terms of social media in particular. I think, if I were to guess, I'd probably use social media the most out of anyone in this room, so to say. Just because I'm on it kind of a lot. And I've had to step away from certain platforms that I notice that I only feel bad after being on. And that's a, you know, it's just a hindrance on my day when I open an app and I'm more frustrated after opening it than I was before. That's what I'm currently worried about more than the long-term.
But that's like your personal relationship with the service or with the app is what you're talking about.
Yeah. And what it's the different ways that it's been designed to build a certain community or,
Right. Okay. Sorry.
The intentions behind designing it have, as a result, made it more frustrating to use, or made it more frustrating to open it and see the people I've. Yeah, it's been more frustrating to open it than not having opened it for the day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, opening it has not improved your day at all, your experience in life.
Right. It's like, what am I doing this to myself? Kind of thing. Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. That's me with Reddit. Just leaves me so disillusioned with humanity.
Mike, I think it's time to get to the final and what is, I think, without question, the most important question that we tend to ask people.
John, sorry. I know what question you're about to ask, and I know it's a very important one. So before you ask that one, I just wanted to comment about the comment that you made beforehand about how we're dealing with technology. Because I heard a story that I found fascinating. It's just a 15-second one. That somebody saw a girl, a little like 5-year-old girl in an airport, and her mother gave her a magazine, and she was trying to swipe through it instead of like flipping pages. Like she figured it out like almost immediately, but her first knee-jerk reaction was to swipe. And I think that speaks volumes, if true.
That is amazing. Yeah. I didn't see that story.
It might be made up. I heard it in a podcast, and you know.
Did the page flip when she swiped?
Eventually it did. It's a 3D swipe.
I will go back, actually. I don't think I answered what I'm most concerned about for the future. And that is, namely, that we stop being innovative.
Do you think it's going to happen?
In my personal view, I have not seen a truly innovative piece of technology in a very long time. Nothing, you know, truly innovative, truly
since 1996.
Probably since like the smartphone. I'd say that's the last most innovative thing. Everything else has been derivative or built on top of, or
what about VR? Is that
before? It's just a new screen. And it also hasn't
the phone is a new screen too. Just smaller. And now bigger and now smaller.
I think that for the most part, it's not really that innovative. I don't think it's really changed what anyone's doing on a daily basis.
Oh, not at the moment. Yeah, I think it will, though. I'm hoping. I'm biased. I love AR, VR stuff.
Well, it's to me, that's a tough one because you say the last innovative thing was the iPhone, right?
Smartphones. I'll generalize.
For smartphones, sure. But that was just a different form factor of software, right? And like a different marketplace. And what was innovative about it?
It certainly altered the way that we interact with the world around us and our interconnectedness with everyone and everything in the world.
But did it technologically do anything that prior products couldn't do? Maybe you had to combine several different products and it wasn't as easy.
I think it's added elements of other pieces of software would not have ever existed had it not been for the smartphone. Google Maps would not have been have improved to the level it is. They would not have been required to map out and work on so many further projects to improve the state of onboard navigation to the point we have it now, without having an impetus like a smartphone. Uber, for a big one, would not exist without smartphone.
Well, I guess one thing it did do is it just made software so available. It was no longer constrained to like a laptop or a PC. It was in your pocket at all times.
Yeah, I think that it's the level of interfaces we were able to add to a normal person every single day. And I think more than that, even, it's allowed us to not have to retain as many things as we necessarily do all the time. When you can just pull up a pocket dictionary on a lo-fi scale, but you just Google things now. You just search things up, and if you want to find a song you're not remembering off the top of your head, you look it up on your phone or you use a Shazam type thing. It's enabled us to offload part of our brain that we may have otherwise retained certain things to a device.
So your concern is that we're not going to have, or that we're maybe at a slower rate innovating.
At a much slower rate.
With software specifically, because if we go beyond the world of software, I can think of a lot of ways that we're innovating.
Yeah, selfie sticks.
In the broader engineering world. But I see what you mean. With software specifically.
I think we've had a dark ages of ad tech. And that's a personal diatribe I'm going to avoid. But
oh, that's a whole...
I think that...
It's the sequel.
I think that we're missing truly innovative software, and I look forward to when we can get back to that. I don't necessarily think I'm going to lead the charge because I don't know what the next step is, but I'm looking forward to whoever and whenever they do it because some big change is needed.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Pablo. I don't think VR and AR is the next step.
No, not the next step. I just think it's a big step.
It is. I think that AR in particular is very interesting because it requires... There was a great video of someone had a grocery list and they were using AR to navigate a shopping a store to purchase everything on a grocery list, which then requires that AR app to know exactly in every store where every piece of food right. and items are. And that would be great. And that's a lot of data and up to the minute yeah. data. And that would be amazing. But there's so many pieces and coordination that needs to happen that...
No, I agree. VR AR is not going to be the next paradigm shift, but I do like it for education a lot. I've seen some demos of, like, you know, a class of engineers that are looking at a wind turbine that it's in the middle of a huge room and they can explore it. A lot of it's proof of concept stuff, but I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm into the flashy stuff that doesn't really help anybody.
All right, let's get to the most important question. Like, what's your favorite pizza topping?
I think I don't know what's been said prior to me, but cheese. I like a plain cheese pizza.
You are the first person to have the correct answer.
is that the correct answer?
There has to be some sort of prize here. Well, it's the correct answer for me.
It's John's correct answer.
I thought it was pepperoni that you were going to say was the correct answer for you, John.
No, John just eats cheese. Calls it good.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, Mike, the pressure was very low because the answer to beat is barbecue sauce and banana peppers. So you could have said like Legos and ketchup, and I think you would have beat that.
Ooh. Yeah. No, I think cheese is, it's where pizza can excel. I think that's, you know, you see it's a true test of how good the pizza is.
Well, there's a reason that the foundation of pizza is cheese and tomato sauce, and then everything else is just a variation of it. It's a modification that some people like, some don't, but it always comes back to the core. Mm-hmm. Of cheese.
Yeah, the cheap ingredients.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Very good.
Do you happen to know, I just learned this recently, what the difference between marinara and pizza sauce is?
I don't know.
Sure. Pizza sauce tends to have a lower moisture count, so it doesn't sog out the pizza while it's cooking, and also tends to be a little bit sweeter.
I feel ignorant. What is a moisture count?
Like more, like there's less water in it. It's more thick.
Okay, that fair enough. Yeah,
not moisture count. Less more moisture, business. lower moisture.
Yeah, moisture content.
Yeah,
yeah.
Interesting.
That's good to know.
I always figured it was the exact same thing with different labels, different marketing.
I would have thought so too until I learned it recently.
Well, that's the last question that we had. I think why don't we do this now, Mike? This has been a really nice episode. I'll give you the opportunity to make any closing comments, and then we'll look forward to our sequel regarding all the future issues to talk about. But why don't you give us any closing comments, given everything we talked about?
I think my only closing comments would be that coming on to this, I definitely thought I was going to be the least technical person you talk to, because I think of my job mostly as being those soft skills and applying them. And it's more coaching and mentoring and talking and convincing and just communication skills. And I think that if more of us applied those things, that everyone would be a bit more proud of the work they do, because the pride comes from your own values and your vision. And if you're doing work that leads towards your vision with your values intact.
That's excellent. I'll also say you are this. It's not a contest for who's more technical and who's,
but they do keep a tally.
Well, I mean, one thing that I think this show maybe can show people is I think everyone's technical in some ways, especially these days, because technology, I mean, what does that even mean? Like, everybody uses technology in one way or another, and it's becoming more and more not like a specialty or an expertise, but just a tool that people use. And some people design the tool and some people use the tool. And correct, we want to have both those types of people on the show. So cool. All right. Well, let's call it there.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Mike. Thanks, Mike. And thanks, Pablo, for joining us as well on this.